Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to speak with Zephyr Teachout. She's running for Attorney General of New York. Then we're going to speak with John Storr. He's a contributor to the Washington Monthly. First, there was this little story this week. I don't know if you caught it. On Thursday, a court in Kazakhstan began considering kind of this sprawling corruption case against a guy named Viktor Krapunov. He was a former mayor of the city of Almaty in Kazakhstan, and his wife, Leila. The couple who are living in Switzerland, where they fled, I guess, are being tried in absentia for, and I quote, a wide array of crimes, including money laundering, embezzlement, abuse of office, fraud, and the creation of an organized crime group, according to Newsweek. So, why am I bringing this up? Well, as you might have guessed, the Krapunovs have, quote, deep ties to the Trump Organization. They were in business with the Bayrock Group, which had been run by former Trump advisor Felix Sater. Sater, if you recall, was a childhood friend of Michael Cohen, and he's been linked to Russian mobsters and also the CIA, right? Because this whole thing is just a ridiculously poorly written John le Carré book. And Sater is also reportedly cooperating with investigators. So he's like this gun waiting to go off. He's the shotgun over the fireplace in Act One. We keep waiting for his shoe to drop. And he has a history of laundering money from families in the Eastern Bloc into Trump properties. And he also has an history of snitching on former business associates in exchange for immunity. This is something that he does. Now, the Krapunovs, back to the Krapunovs, were also in business with Rudy Giuliani's old law firm. The firm opened an office in Kazakhstan in 2007. That was the same year that the couple fled to Switzerland. The firm was allegedly used to raise funds for Giuliani's 2008 presidential run. The Krapunov son, Ilya Krapunov, is also wanted by Ukrainian authorities for allegedly, quote, orchestrating a hack of the computer systems of a law firm representing the Kazakh bank, BTA Bank. Okay. The son, Ilya Krapunov, his father-in-law is accused of embezzling billions from that same bank, BTA Bank. And that money was subsequently laundered through Trump Towers. So why do I bring all of this up? Well, just as a reminder that Robert Mueller, and not only Robert Mueller, there are different investigations. There's an international investigation into the Krapunovs. But Robert Mueller has 27, I believe, extremely skilled and diligent investigators with experience in white collar crime and organized crime and corruption. And they've been digging through this president's incredibly dense web of business associates and shady characters and following the money for over a year now. And we have no clue what's going to come out at the end of all of that, because look, have you even heard of this story? Have you even heard of this story in Kazakhstan? I hadn't until this week. All right, on that note, stay tuned. And speaking of corruption, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break. Then we're going to come back with someone who wants to fight corruption, Zephyr Teachout.
Blaze on Impala, diamond rock waller, R10 howler, never leading out. boys off. I'm a 20-inch crawler, bust a left or right. I'm out of sight, I'm throw. I'm bouncing off the road, I'm in the modem and the bottom, chain and chum. Hop by my big body form, chain with the chum. Can't forgive me what alarm. I'm hopping by, I'm looking good. Diamonds get some wood. Man, it's understood. Got money in my hood. I'm pushing big body, can't stop me. For the 9-8, gotta sell a million copy. I'ma crow slow, puffin' on the optimo, hit the stove. I'ma go real slow, puffin' on the optimo. I'ma let the man, I'm looking clean. One more control, get green and night bust.
Wanna be a baller, shot caller, 20-inch blaze on the Impala. Caller, get lit tonight. Swish a tight, got spray behind. I hit the highway, making money the flyway. But it's got to be a better way, a better way, better way.
Welcome back. I'm Joshua Hahn, and I'm really excited to have my next guest on the show. Zephyr Teachout is a legal scholar at Fordham University, and she's running to become the next Attorney General for the great state of New York. Zephyr, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be on. It's great to talk to you.
I am thrilled to have you. Now, I should say, in the interest of full disclosure and maybe too much disclosure, I live in New York's 19th Congressional District, where Zephyr lost a tough race in 2016. I canvassed for her a little bit. I made a small donation to her campaign. So I don't even know
this,
if I need to say that.
This just says you're on the side of good. So thank
I'm
you.
I don't even know if I need to say that, but I'm just going to
cover
the bases
there.
Yeah.
Actually, no, I really believe you should.
I
used to be the national director of the Sunlight Foundation. Transparency is critical. So
transparency is a good thing. So there you go.
Yes, it's a good thing.
Zephyr, before we get into your campaign, I wanted to take advantage of the fact that you're a legal scholar on the show and ask you about a ruling this week in a lawsuit that you're involved in, which seems like a pretty big deal. Can you, before we get into the AG race, can you just give us a brief rundown of what happened with this emolument suit against Trump?
Yeah, there's a major, major decision this week, one that could lead to Donald Trump being forced to give up his hotel in D.C., and certainly is likely to lead to other states joining, and eventually Donald Trump having to divest all his business interests. So let me explain. President Trump is taking foreign money through his businesses, which is in violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. For example, the Chinese government is renting, is a major leaseholder in Trump Tower in New York City. So the Chinese government then is putting cash into Donald Trump's pockets. Trump is also taking state government money through state workers and state projects, funding, visiting his hotels or using his facilities. That's also in violation of another parallel emoluments clause in the Constitution. 3 days after Trump took office, I was one of the lawyers on a lawsuit that is still ongoing. It's a similar lawsuit where we represent restaurant professionals and hotel professionals who are competing with Trump for business while he's violating the Constitution. These lawsuits were the Maryland and D.C. state attorneys general representing the people of their states saying, hey, Trump, you are violating the Constitution and it's got to stop. A few months ago, there was another significant ruling in this case, but this was the biggest deal. This early significant ruling was that the D.C. and Maryland attorneys general were the right people to bring this suit. They could bring this lawsuit because that's one of the big questions. Even if he's violating the Constitution,
they had standing.
Even if he's violating the Constitution, who can challenge that violation?
You have to be harmed.
You have to be harmed. And the restaurant owners are also harmed. The initial Southern District of New York, Judge Daniels said that we did not have standing. I'm confident we're going to win on appeal. But that early decision this spring saying D.C. and Maryland attorneys general is a really big deal. But not as big as a deal as what happened this week, which is the next question was, okay, before we even get into fact finding, before we really look at Trump's finances and find out where and how foreign money and state government money is flowing to him, we need to know that it's a violation, that it could plausibly be a violation. And in order to know that, we have to understand what an emolument is. So this is a term that had never before been defined in federal courts. This is a huge case of first impression. What constitutes an emolument? And essentially what Trump's lawyer said is the only thing that is illegal is if it's a bribe.
Right.
It's not just any money flowing. There has to be some kind of quid pro quo exchange. And I'm being a little superficial on the argument, but
no, we have to
understand the gist of it.
Yeah, right.
And what the Maryland and D.C. attorneys general said, which is something I have been arguing since 7 days after Donald Trump took office. I, in fact, wrote the first New York Times op-ed about how he was violating the Constitution, is that, no, the Constitution is the reading of the text and context and purpose of this clause is that if it's a benefit that it's flowing to a federal officer, it's an emolument. And the court found that. And that's a huge deal because, yes, we need to go to discovery and find out all the details. But on its face, this court, if you match up that legal definition and the facts as we already undisputably know them, Trump is violating the Constitution, according to this court.
And this court found that the judge ruled that the emoluments clause has to be interpreted broadly, right? I mean, he said this is the way that the framers intended it to be.
Yeah. I mean, I would, my only quibble is that it's not that it's broad, it's that it's accurate. So
right.
In fact, what the Trump's lawyers were saying is that's a broad reading, but it's really the only common sense reading.
Right.
And I would sort of turn your sentence upside down and say the government's reading was just bizarrely cramped and illogical.
And I think the judge actually mentioned that, right? There was something about how this was a ludicrous, the government's reading was ludicrously narrow. You're right.
Yes. And also just to boast a little bit, I was really proud because this is an area that I've been writing in for some time. I wrote a book related to these topics, and the court case did cite me substantially throughout. And I felt quite vindicated that an argument that I've been pushing for now about a decade really got a nice hearing in this decision.
This gives us a segue into the AG's race, I think. Arguably the most important question at this point in time for a candidate for this office is this. We have an erratic president who appears to flout the law. In Washington, he enjoys impunity by congressional majority. Republicans on Capitol Hill are too intimidated to provide real oversight. These, you know, hold hearings, get into the nitty-gritty of what's going on. He hasn't disclosed his taxes, et cetera, and his business interests are not all of them, but many of his business interests are in New York. So we have the disgraced former Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. He had a reputation of being aggressive with the Trump regime. I would like to ask you: do you think that reputation was earned, and how would you differ in your approach?
Yeah. I, first of all, thanks for that framework. And I just want to underline something about it, and then I'll answer your question. I know people know that there's all kinds of problems with the Trump, to put it mildly, with the legality of the Trump administration. And there's a tendency to look, understandably, to Mueller as the representative of the institution that can do something about it. But it's really important to understand that state AGs, and in particular the New York State Attorney General, can do things that Congress can't do, that the Senate can't do, that a blue Congress can't do, that state governors can't do, and that are uniquely within the responsibility and authority of the New York State AG because Donald Trump's businesses are here and because, again, based on news reports, there's a lot of reason to believe that there's a lot of illegality in those businesses and in the foundation. So that the New York State AG has unique ability to essentially follow the money and follow the follow and ask questions, sue, and as appropriate, prosecute for illegal behavior related to the Trump Organization and the Trump Foundation. I just can't underline that enough, because I think sometimes there's a sort of a two-pronged approach, which is everything is Mueller or a blue Congress. But in fact, the New York State AG's office is a critical, critical backstop for law at this moment when Trump and the administration are lawless. So Schneiderman rightly had a reputation for being a leader on critical lawsuits against formal actions of the Trump administration. And that is something that Barbara Underwood has continued with extraordinary vigor. Our current attorney general is somebody I admire enormously. She's a total powerhouse. And just to give an example, these are lawsuits against the illegal EPA rollbacks,
right.
Lawsuits against against the Muslim ban, Underwood's recent lawsuit against family separation. 100 or so lawsuits saying that what the administration in its formal role is doing is illegal. And we need those. And as Attorney General, I would absolutely pursue those. The area where I pressed then Attorney General, really from the beginning of the Trump administration, and believe that he should have acted, and as Attorney General, I will act in, is in going after Trump's businesses. So not in his formal administrative role, but rather in his quote-unquote private role. And that involves both the emoluments lawsuit. I mentioned that Maryland and D.C. were brought these suits. The attorneys general there are fantastic, great. But there's a gaping hole, because they the heart of Donald Trump's businesses are in New York State. So that case that's going forward covers the businesses in the Maryland and D.C. area, but not the beating heart of the Trump Organization. So that to me is critical. This is a you have to follow the money and the source of power. It's not just the emoluments suit, though. The Attorney General of New York State has a special authority and responsibility to preserve the integrity under New York State's own laws, not just the U.S. Constitution, the integrity of businesses and nonprofits in New York. That includes the power to investigate lawlessness, restrain lawlessness, and in extreme cases, dissolve corporations or dissolve foundations. So just a month after Barbara Underwood took over as the Attorney General, and for your listeners, she's not running in the fall. If and when I win, I will definitely ask her to stay on as Solicitor General. But just a month after she took over from Eric Schneiderman, she brought a lawsuit along these lines, a lawsuit seeking to dissolve the Trump Foundation. And I think the simplest way to understand it is that there's some lawsuits are shields and some lawsuits are swords. Some are shields against illegal behavior, and they're absolutely critical. But we also need to use the law as a sword and go after the heart of Trump's power, which is his foundation and his businesses. Does that make sense?
Excellent metaphor. Very, very clear. Do you see a scenario, a potential scenario, where Trump has to choose between his office and his extensive business holdings? Is that a possible end game?
Yes, and that has been, again, this is something a week after he was elected, not just took office, but was elected, mid-November 2016, has been very clear that the Constitution requires that he must fully divest his business interests, so that there's a true blind trust, not a fake blind trust, of liquidated assets there's no possibility of a foreign government, Chinese government, being able to basically pass cash to the president,
right.
The emoluments clause, which is what's happening now. And so that is a choice that the Constitution clearly requires. And it's a very reasonable choice to say, because right now there is a radical question mark after every single one of Donald Trump's statements about foreign policy that came into sharp relief last week. There is a question mark about every single trade decision, about every single military decision, about every single procurement decision. It radically destabilizes any sense of confidence around national security and trade to have foreign money flowing to our president's pockets. And so it is a reasonable and constitutionally mandated choice, is a choice that I and many others urged him to make prior to holding office. And to give you a sense of how much, I don't want to say he knows, I'm not a...
Yeah, we don't know.
But how important this was. You may recall the press conference right before he took office, where there was a stack of folders.
Yes.
Next to him, and he brought his lawyers. So, what was the thing he was bringing his lawyers to defend, and what was the thing he needed to talk about before becoming president? The most urgent thing. And it was a defense of holding on to his businesses because it's so obviously wrong. I think sometimes people feel a little impatient, but these cases are moving forward in federal courts. And that impatience leads to a sense that, well, if nothing's happened already, it's not going to happen. But these cases are moving forward, and I can't overstate the importance of the decision last week. It was a gorgeously written opinion. Of course, yes, Trump's lawyers are going to appeal, but this is a blockbuster moment for law and for getting to that moment, which we should have been at a long time ago, which is that Donald Trump has to choose.
And if you were to pursue this Seward lawsuit, presume that you would be able to get your hands on Trump's tax returns in discovery.
Yeah. Look, I don't want to particularly define all the elements that would come through in
sure.
discovery or in a discovery fight. But the truth is, I'll first speak as a citizen and then about this lawsuit. Just as a person in this country, it is outrageous that we do not know the flow of money and that
yes.
we have not had his tax returns. I mean, it's a weekly reminder. CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics, I was on their board. I had to step down to run for Attorney General, but they've done fantastic work in this area. I mean, truly epic uncovering of conflicts. They have a weekly reminder that this is the first president not to disclose tax returns. So that's something we separately should always be calling for.
Yeah.
But in the context of an emoluments lawsuit, you need to know where the money flow is.
Yes.
And so without targeting any particular
documents.
I mean, the documents.
Right. There's different sources of information. You'd be able to follow
yeah.
the money trail. That's the main thing.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what people are looking for when they're looking for the taxes.
Absolutely. And let me
yeah.
just remind listeners that Donald Trump promised that there would be no foreign deals cut with his organization while he was president, and has just blatantly gone back on that promise repeatedly. This has been reported again and again and again. He's cutting foreign deals, and there are obviously the Chinese telecom company ZTE, the most obvious example, where you almost saw in the same week as the Chinese government-sponsored company put $500 million into a Trump development deal. Then he came out the very next day or the following week and said, we have to save this Chinese company, after he's been going after China for years and years and years. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Zephyr Teachout. She's vying to become New York State's next attorney general.
And one of the things I just want to underline is that the role of attorney general changes with the context. When Ronald Reagan came into office, Bob Abrams was the Attorney General in New York State. And up until then, the Attorney General's job had been primarily defending the state. That's still a substantial part of the job, to be clear.
Sure.
But he and his office really stepped up and said, okay, if Reagan's going to stop protecting our air and water, I'm going to pursue it. And really turned it into an offensive office as well as defensive one, the regulator of last resort. We are in a moment now where the context is also changing the job of Attorney General. And I have my whole life been focused on these questions of anti-corruption laws, constitutional law, and it's essential that this office be that the power of this office be maximized to stop the national threat, but also in New York, as your listeners may know, we have our own corruption problem. So, you know, the work that I've been doing my whole life is now painfully relevant at this moment, and I think I bring some unique skills and background to this job.
Zephyr, you keep giving me perfect segues because I wanted to switch to New York. I wanted to switch to New York. Uh-huh. So we're recording this on Saturday, the 28th, and yesterday, Sheldon Silver, he was the former Speaker of the New York State Assembly. He was sentenced to 7 years in prison for basically selling his office for, I believe, it was $4 million in kickbacks and bribes. And I think the media loved this storyline about a leftist insurgency fighting the centrist establishment. But here in Kingston, New York, where I live, I know a lot of people who aren't that political and are sick and tired of the seemingly never-ending corruption in Albany. I mean, there have been sexual harassment scandals.
Exactly. Yep.
Silver, in fact, helped cover them up. I genuinely don't understand how the state of affairs has persisted for so long. Tell us this with your shield and sword idea, right? So, Attorney General Zephyr Teachout, how are you going to address this? Just persist in this dogged problem in Albany that really, I think, undermines the whole progressive project.
It undermines the progressive project, and it's directly hurting people. People are rightly sick and tired of it, kind of exhausted. They check out, which is one of the most dangerous things that can happen. But there's also this real pain and suffering that's caused by it, and I'll talk about what we can do, but before we get to that, I just want to remind people that corruption leads to poverty. Corruption gets in the way of good jobs. Corruption gets in the way of clean air and water. One of the trials this year involved somebody close to the governor, Joe Prococo, and he's convicted. And what he was trying to do is help build a dirty power plant. And so people then are stuck with that power plant going forward, despite the health risks, because of his corruption. Or the trial that recently ended around the Buffalo Billion. This is a bid rigging trial. Was the heart of the trial was $750 million of state money going to major donors instead of going to places that desperately need economic development. So in Utica, you have an average family salary of $30,000 a year. They're desperately looking for economic development. That economic development money is supposed to go to them, and instead it goes to big donors. So the costs are extraordinary. And the costs of covering up sexual harassment are extraordinary. The number of women who come to Albany with big ideas, with incredible talents, with a determination to serve the public, who then are first harassed, abused, and in some cases raped. That's what Shelley Silver was involved in covering up, who are then not only pushed out, but when they complain are demeaned, sometimes fired. So the costs here are epic. And then to your point, New York State should be the living counterexample to Donald Trump's America. And instead, we don't even have a DREAM Act passed in New York. So lots of problems in New York. This is another example of where the role of Attorney General changes with the context. Ideally, Albany could police itself, but it just can't. You know, there's effort after effort, with more, greater, or less sincerity, and I think a lack of sincerity behind a lot of these efforts to
Can I interrupt you for a second? Let me interrupt you for listeners who are not in New York. What Zephyr is referring to, what Zephyr's talking about is that every session, they'll put together this like anti-corruption package, and it always goes nowhere. So there's this constant thing where people are arrested, people are thrown in jail, and politicians from across the political, the ideological spectrum say, this time we're going to really get serious about it. And they never do. And this has been going on for as long as I can remember. I'm sorry. Yep. I just needed to let people know.
I think New Yorkers know this.
I don't know that people in Nebraska know this, but this is what's been going on in New York. It's outrageous.
No, they don't. I think there's a sense for folks elsewhere in the country that, oh, New York, you know, New York's pretty blue. And must be pretty progressive and are shocked when they learn about what's actually happening in our government and the number of corruption trials. And so, anyway, just to explain what I meant about context is what that means is that the Attorney General in New York State is an independently elected position. In some states, Attorney General is appointed. The New York Attorney General is independently elected and has an obligation to the people. First, to the people, to her conscience, to the rule of law, not to the governor, not to the legislature. And because of this ongoing scandal, the Attorney General really needs to be leading the fight in investigating corruption, prosecuting corruption, investigating and prosecuting sexual misconduct. And that is what I would do as Attorney General, while supporting efforts for more serious structural reforms. But right now, there's an agency in New York that's supposed to oversee corruption and sexual misconduct, and instead, it's a classic example of an agency that's doing the opposite of what it's supposed to. It's protecting those in power. It isn't really investigating, and it's actually been involved in being fairly dismissive towards victims who've come forward. And so that's the reality on the ground. So as Attorney General, I would make investigating corruption in Albany a priority. I know that doesn't make me a lot of friends in at the pinnacles of power in Albany right now. But, you know, that's part of the point is that you need to have an independent, truly, truly independent Attorney General. Now, not all jobs have independence as their top requirement. But when it comes to law enforcement, that is, in fact, the primary requirement is that there are no dependencies, there are no entanglements. And I have been independent to a fault. And there's four candidates running for this office. I'm the only one who, in the short 2 months since the campaign started, has directly called out Andrew Cuomo's own role in this. And that's important because part of what that means, part of what independence means, is being willing to say, yes, the governor is wrong. Yes, the governor must take responsibility.
Once again, your segue foo is amazing. Like you should just host yourself. I mean, okay. So I don't want to ask a lot about the horse race stuff, but this was literally next on my notes. So you're running in this 4-person field, as you say. Leisha Eve is a former lobbyist and aide to Andrew Cuomo. She has a lot of old Clinton hand supporting her. Joe Trippi's working on her campaign. She kind of is associated with that wing of the party. You have Sean Patrick Maloney. He's a member of Congress. He's in, and I will editorialize here for a second and just say that personally, I think his run is kind of irresponsible because he represents a competitive district. And if he were to win, he'd kind of leave Democrats scrambling to get a new candidate lined up to replace him. Incumbency is an advantage, and Democrats would lose that leg up in New York's 18th district, which he represents, and they could very well lose the seat as a result. And I want to ask you about your fourth opponent, who is New York City public advocate Letitia James. And I was speaking with a friend here the other day, and she said something to the effect of, she said, you know, I love Zephyr Teachout, but I don't understand why she's running against Letitia James, who is a solid progressive with a pretty strong track record. You know, she ran on the Working Families Party line. She's certainly not a compromised person. And she comes from the progressive wing of the party, if you will. And she has a shot at becoming the first African-American woman to win statewide office. How would you respond to that? Do you disagree with that evaluation?
Well, look, I am running because I believe that I bring both a unique background, especially in anti-corruption law and constitutional law. What folks may not know is that I was actually started my career as a death penalty lawyer and care also passionately about using the Office of Attorney General to fight for criminal justice reform, which has been an mass incarceration cash bail. So I bring a set of experiences that I think make me uniquely qualified for this particular job. And then I would just say about, again, in the last 2 months since the campaign started, there have been a series of moments where independence has been required. And all of the other three candidates have been silent at moments that I have spoken out. One thing I haven't mentioned is that I'm the only candidate who's not taking corporate money. And in New York State, that's a big deal. It's a big deal everywhere. But in New York State, there's a capacity for corporations to give directly to campaigns. So that's passing up hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm the only candidate who has called out Andrew Cuomo's role in these corruption scandals. I'm the only candidate who has called for Cuomo's former lawyer, Seth Agata, who runs this embarrassment of an ethics agency who's been really enabling corruption in Albany, calling on him to resign. The two others have been asked about it, have refused to call on him to resign. I don't think Sean Patrick Maloney has been asked about it, but he hasn't spoken out about it. I'm the only one. We have a situation in New York where there's a bunch of people generously called breakaway Democrats, but they're called the IDC. They're people who run as Democrats and then support Republicans in office. A court found last month that they took money illegally.
Yeah.
And I'm running for a law enforcement job. This is not complicated. You say return the illegal money, in campaign finance money. None of the other candidates have spoken out about that. Actually, no, that's not true. I'll be fair. I was at an event with Lisa Eve, and she had not spoken out about it. Now she did, but the other two candidates still have not. And at this moment, when we're facing the threat of Donald Trump, I was calling for several weeks for Andrew Cuomo. Again, these are markers of independence where you have to be willing to call on Cuomo. That's where you see the big differences. And I said, hey, look, we need to give Attorney General Barbara Underwood the authority to criminally prosecute Trump, the Trump Foundation, and criminally investigate Trump, the Trump Foundation, for violations related to the civil suit that Underwood had been undertaking. This is a no-brainer. Give Barbara Underwood the tools she needs so she can maximize her investigative powers in regard to Trump, where there should be no question. None of the other candidates, and this was a public call that was in the New York Times. This wasn't some secret call that they didn't know about.
Right.
None of the other candidates spoke up. Eventually, Andrew Cuomo did respond and did say that he would provide that authority, which was a major moment. And I'm proud of my role in calling on him to do something that was necessary and he should have done 20 months ago. But when you look at all four candidates, I have been consistent in showing that independence, and none of the other three have.
Zephyr Teachout, I have to say, just again, editorializing, and I think that a lot of us are very eager to see what might be possible with a gifted, very progressive legal scholar having the kind of power that comes with the office of the New York Attorney General. Zephyr Teachout, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it. I know you're super busy with your campaign.
I really do appreciate it. Yes. And
my
thanks
pleasure.
To your listeners for listening. Take care.
Thanks so much, Zephyr. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and come right back. Thank you. Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm pleased to welcome John Storr back to the show. John is a contributing writer to the Washington Monthly. John Storr, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with me. So, do you ever get the sense that there is no bottom in this regime, that every week that you think, okay, things couldn't be wackier than this week, and then the next week, somehow, it gets wackier? And this was, I think, just a, I mean, I would say it was a turning point for any other administration, but not for this one.
No, well, we keep thinking that we arrive at a turning point, and then the turning point fades into another and into another, and then we wonder, well, when's the turn going to actually take place?
I think it might come quickly and without a lot of, I mean, if it comes, it may come quickly without a lot of notice. Like, we may not see it coming. I saw someone on Twitter noted that Richard Nixon had a very strong support within the Republican Party until the very end.
That's right. And I think that's just the way conservatives tend to think. Because with conservative, and I don't mean this in any unkind or unfair kind of way. I just think it's just the way it is in their view of the world, that conviction overrides reason, and they just believe that they're winning right up to the moment that they lose. The unfortunate difference is that in Nixon's era, Democrats were in charge, and we're not in that situation. And so, with the Republicans doing nothing, it would be being in charge of Congress but doing nothing, we're actually not quite able to see if they've lost yet. Do you see what I mean?
Like, yeah.
We only know if they lose after the Democrats win in November.
You know, one other very big difference, and I think that this is actually perhaps the biggest difference, is that back in Nixon's time, we would all watch, like, the CBS Evening News. We had a common set of facts that, you know, we could have very strong differences of opinion, but there was kind of one overarching reality. This was before the internet period. This was before the kind of post-truth politics period. And when you ask me what's up with Republicans, the defining issue is what's known as motivated reasoning. And we all do this. Liberals and people on the left do this all the time. My God. But in order for motivated reasoning, that is the tendency to accept evidence which supports your strongly held positions and reject evidence that conflicts with it. As far as motivated reasoning goes, you need to have an alternative storyline. And the conservative media provides that every single day. And it's stunning to me to see how brazen they are. Like, you know, we had the administration released the Carter Page, the application to surveil Carter Page, the FBI's application. It completely undermined basically the entire story that conservatives have been telling for the last year. And instead of revisiting that story or saying, well, okay, we've been proven wrong, they doubled down and they said that application actually vindicated them, which is, it almost reminds me of a cargo cult. You know,
absolutely.
You have this thing where the cargo is the god, and then you learn that it isn't, and you just keep going as if the cargo is the god. And we had this this remarkable 2-day period where Michael Cohen, Trump's fixer, said that he had been, you know, aware. First, he released the Cohen tape, and then he said that he was aware of the infamous meeting at the Trump Tower. We had that moment, and this was all in like a 2-day period, that we had that moment when the President of the United States told an audience of veterans, just remember what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening. It's just like one thing after another. It's happening so fast. I think this is also part of it. It happens so fast that you can barely digest one outrage before the next one presents itself.
Yeah, that's right. And the media is exhausted, and but I don't. I actually hold the media partly responsible. And I don't, what I mean by media is not you and me, opinion writers, or Fox News. I mean like straight, legit, straight ahead reporting.
Yeah.
I hold them responsible too. I have a theory, and I don't know I don't know if I can prove it. But my theory is that the power of Fox News and other conservative media is really only influential to the extent that legitimate media keeps respecting it as something to be taken seriously. So what I mean is that there will be a change when legitimate reporters like CNN, New York Times, etc., they look at Fox News and the Daily Caller and Breitbart. There will be a change when they look at all of them and say, you are not real news, all of you. You know, we will not associate with you professionally. We will not associate with you socially. You are of a lower class in the world of journalism. That's not the case right now. You have, right. You know, I remember Glenn Thrush, the former presidential campaign reporter for the Times, saying on Twitter, like, the Breitbart reporters were just as legitimate as anybody else. And there's the problem right there.
Yeah.
You can't legitimize. I know you might be friends. I know maybe you go out to dinner. You might even be sleeping with one of those reporters. But you can't legitimize what they're doing because they're not doing real reporting. Even if half of them are, like, the problem is that with Fox News, as a lot of people know, is like half of it's actually pretty straightforward reporting, and then the other half is propaganda, right? That doesn't matter. I think there would be a real change when the whole lot of them are pariahs, they're persona non gratas. Until real journalists draw a line, you know, and I'm talking about like Stelter over at CNN, you know, where he's like, he's basically the moral conscience right now.
Right. That's media reporter Brian Stelter.
Thank you. And he's actually starting to move the line saying, you know, that like this, we have to say this is journalism and this is not. And once you do that, there will be a change. And here's why I do have some evidence to back up this theory. There's two pieces of evidence. In both of these cases, the media stopped playing along with the president, and in both cases, the president was finally revealed to be very weak. And in both cases, when people saw him as being weak, his poll numbers dropped. The one case is with the border crisis, after he formally said that his administration would no longer separate children from their parents. And the other was the Helsinki episode where he, you know, blatantly took the side of Russian President Vladimir Putin. In both of those cases, the media was like, what? You know, they couldn't have footage of wailing children and crying mothers and you couldn't look at that and say, oh, maybe there's two sides to this story. There isn't two sides to this story. The government was being tyrannical. You know, there's not two sides. And then they looked at when you look at Trump standing next to Vladimir Putin and Trump is taking Putin's side, there's no two sides to that story. This is what it is. And in both those cases, when the media stopped playing along, when they stopped saying, oh, you know, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, then everybody was able to see what this president is all about. So I do have hope that at some point there will be a change, a shift in the way we do journalism. It's not all just a lying president, though that's obviously the core problem. It's how we're covering the lying president and the information that voters are receiving. That's an issue, too. One of my pet theories that you may know is that most people, most of the time, have something better to do than pay attention to politics. It's just the way it is. Life is complicated. Politics are complicated. And, you know, you have children and jobs and things that just have a higher priority, right?
Yes.
So normal people rely on shortcuts. you know, I need to make a decision about do I like this person or don't I like this person. And if the media is havesies, you know, like, we don't know who's telling the truth, we don't know who's bad and who's good, then an automatic shortcut is to go to the partisan media to help you think something through, or just to tell you what to think.
I strongly agree with you about the importance of the ostensibly neutral, the professional media, the mainstream media, rejecting these kind of narratives that come from the right and then are almost laundered into the mainstream press. We saw that during the 2016 election. Of course, the most obvious example was the Clinton cash book, which was sponsored by Steve Bannon, written by a former Breitbart contributor, and then really legitimized by the New York Times and the Washington Post. So, but here's the reason that I'm not optimistic. We had Yoshi Benkler on the show. He's the Harvard legal scholar who did that study for the Berkman Klein Center for the Internet and Society, right? Do you remember this study where they kind of, they mapped who, not only who was consuming which media, but who was linking to different media back and forth, who was sharing what on social media, et cetera, et cetera. And what they found was this kind of, this media ecosystem where people on the center right, from everywhere from the center right to the hard left, right, kind of consume a distribution of media. So if you're kind of center right, you'll read the National Review, et cetera, et cetera. You'll probably read Breitbart as well, but you're also going to read the New York Times. You're going to read the Washington Post. If you're a person on the left, it's the same way. You'll read from maybe Jacobin or the Washington Monthly or the Nation, whatever, but you'll also read those conservative, those mainstream outlets as well. And you'll give them credence. And the only group that this was not true of, according to this study, was the kind of conservative base. And they have this kind of just almost exclusive focus on Breitbart, the Daily Caller, and Fox News. And they really don't live in the same universe, even to the degree that, you know, the rest of the media were to call out those outlets, I don't know that they would be swayed by that. And that is that, you know, hardcore Trump base that, although small in number, is extraordinarily consequential in our politics right now because it scares the bejesus out of Republicans on Capitol Hill and keeps them from doing any real oversight. So I don't know. I don't know where we're at. We're in kind of uncharted territory as we have been since the election, basically. We only have a couple more minutes. Let me switch while we have just another minute or two to the Michael Cohen's revelation. So Michael Cohen is completely untrustworthy as a person. We all know that. Like he's the least trustworthy person in the world other than Donald Trump. You know, like he's right. More credible than Donald Trump, but that's such a low bar. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he says, the thing that strikes me is that what he says is so obvious. Like everybody knows that there is no way that Donald Trump's entire inner circle meets with a bunch of Russians to get dirt on Hillary Clinton without Donald Trump's advanced knowledge. And okay, because we know this because he is a micromanager, a notorious micromanager. He's not a details guy, but he knows he has his finger on everything that's going on. So I don't know where we're at. We need, you know, Michael Cohen has no, does he have evidence? Are there others that can corroborate that? Is that the question we're asking? Is that the nub of it?
That is, as far as I can tell from CNN's reporting, that he doesn't have a recording. It'll be his witness testimony along with others against Trump. And then, so the question is, who do you trust, right? But I actually like to, I think you should look at it more realistically. And it's probably, the real question is, who do you distrust least? You know, and that's not, that is a low bar, but it's not a meaningless assessment. I mean, if you distrust one person more than the other, then that's a meaningful difference.
Yeah.
You know, and also, but the other thing too is, I mean, as of right now, there's another way of looking at it. As of right now, who would you give the benefit of the doubt to? I mean, what we know now is that this president has told 3,200 some lies in 500 some, nearly 500 days, right?
Yeah.
And we don't know as much about Cohen's rate of lying, but we know he's a liar. We know he's a, you know,
he's a dirtbag. Yeah,
he's a dirtbag. We know that, yeah. But we don't know, like, we haven't measured quantitatively.
Yes.
His rate of lying. So I think, you know, for now anyway, he deserves the benefit of the doubt. And I'm speaking in terms of public opinion. Legal investigation. So, you know, as of right now, you know, let's give him the benefit of the doubt and see what happens.
I go back to this thing that you evaluate claims in context. There is no way that Donald Trump did not know about that meeting in advance.
Right.
There is the phone call from Junior, one just before the meeting, one just after, to a blocked number. We know Donald Trump used a phone with a blocked number. It's obvious that he was, I mean, it's obvious. All of these denials have been just obviously lies, right? So it's like, yes, I as I told you on Twitter the other day, you know, I don't trust Michael Cohen, but if I come in out of the rain and I'm soaking wet and he says it's raining outside, I'm not going to doubt it, right? I'm like, he's just stating the obvious, which is that, of course, Trump knew. The question is, who else was in the room? Because he said there were others in the room. Who were those people? I think Mueller is out ahead of everybody. And, you know, he's had 25 investigators looking into all these things. He knows much more than any of us knew. And I hope it all comes out in the wash, as they say. John Storr, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks, Josh.
Folks, check out John's work at the Washington Monthly and follow him on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
John A. Storr, STOEHR.
Thank you so much. I also want to thank Zephyr Teachout. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can get your show. I'd also like to thank the good folks at Crooks and Liars and Hullabaloo and the Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their respective joints. You can write an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. Of course, I would like to thank you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. Pa' una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar.